Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversation with artists. On today's show, legendary Scottish fiddler Alistair Fraser talks about his upcoming spring concerts. Then Justice is spelled with a Z and the opera Zorro, and a food photographer is inspired by his Mexican culture. Today's show is about carrying on culture and traditions. That's all coming up. Keep it locked and stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. Alistair Fraser has been playing the fiddle for practically his whole life. Next month, he turned 70. He picked up the fiddle when he was a little boy in Scotland, and his classmates teased him because they thought carrying a fiddle wasn't cool. And you know how these stories go. Despite the kids' teases, he kept playing anyway, and he's now considered one of the great cultural bearers of traditional Scottish fiddle music. He performs all over the world. Back in 1999, he played at the Kennedy Center Honors in tribute to actor Sean Connery. Mr. Fraser founded the San Francisco Scottish Fiddlers, and they have spring concerts coming up April 25th through 27th in Davis, San Rafael, and Santa Rosa. Alistair Fraser took a short break from touring to chat with me about his upcoming show and his love for music. Alistair Fraser, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Wow, you have such a just interesting background, and I was reading some of your story about how you started playing the fiddle. Can you tell us how you started? I know you were a little boy.
Yeah, I mean, the fiddle is my life. So I started playing because there was a fiddle in my house, and you know, my family were interested in the music, and I had the fortune to get the job. You know, I was 7 or 8 years old, and they said, "Why doesn't young Alistair get violin lessons?" And so I did, and never thinking it would become kind of a major force in my life as it has been, but what a joy that is. And it's, you know, I follow the fiddle, as I like to say, but playing any music leads you into community and leads you into the most amazing places. You know, you learn a lot about life and about humanity and what a privilege it is. So I've spent my life playing music, asking questions, sharing the journey, and it's just been a joy, and I love it.
Thank you. And we appreciate the music and the artistry that you put out into the world. So I was reading on your website that you when you were little, you were playing your grandfather's fiddle. Do you still have your grandfather's fiddle?
No, that's long gone. I've gone through a few fiddles since then. But, you know, you fall in love with certain violins at certain stages of life. It's an ongoing quest. But, you know, as the years go on, you find instruments that speak to you and that you want to take on the journey. So I don't know how many fiddles I've owned at this point. It's great because all these fiddles, they tell a story. You know, you can hold a violin and you can almost channel the ancestors. You can think, who used to own them? Where has it been? What kind of adventures has it had? And under whose chin has this violin been, you know, for so many years?
And I understand you know, you talked about living in the Bay Area for a long time. And you worked as a scientist for BP, British Petroleum, and that brought you to California in the early 80s. What gave you the courage to follow your musical heart? Because I know for some artists, you know, that's scary to leave a quote unquote traditional job to go into art.
Wow. Yeah, well, I thank you for that question, because that's really an important question. I think one that comes up a lot, you know, as I speak to other people on life's journey. And what am I going to do? You know, am I going to have a secure life of trying to find a good job? Or am I going to lead the life of an artist where you never know where the next penny is going to come from? And it is a big question for a lot of people. So yes, I got a degree as a physicist. I got a job as a physicist. All the time I was playing music, you know, never stopped. And so I was always wrestling with that question. Should I lead a life in art and music, or should I be problem solving and asking questions in physics and science? And there is no either or, you know, I still love it all. But I was fortunate enough to kind of have this thought as I was actually in San Francisco working one night, and I was working away somewhere downtown, and I just leaned back in my chair and I thought about music and the role of music in people's lives. For me, it's fundamental. It's not something that you add on. Music is a force. And I leaned back in my chair and I had this thought where there's no one on this planet that cannot be influenced by music. Like, music is a universal force. And then I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to do music. It's not a trivial thing. You know, it's not something I'm going to add on after my work or after my job. It's actually going to be the core of what I do. So I just quit the next day. And I'm so glad I did that, you know, that I had that thought, because I could have spent years and years and years thinking about it. So I encourage people, you know, to go for it. If they're thinking of leading a life in art and living in the question in that way, if you can do it, if you can, and not everyone can for various reasons, but I had the opportunity and I have not regretted it.
And now you're like an icon. I mean, you know, you're considered one of the great, you know, fiddler players. So how does that make you feel?
Oh, I just feel lucky to do what I do. And that's the honest truth of it. If you follow your heart, follow your bliss, doors open. Like, I travel around and I go into different communities and villages and international places. And I find this common language with people all over the world. And what a gift that is. You know, I mean, I'm sure you know yourself, like, if you get to sing songs and you get to hang out with people who have music, and not just the music, but the social interaction that happens around music. It's so important for our humanity. And so I get to do that. And I love it, you know, especially in the early years. I worked a lot. You know, I tried to get good at what I was doing. And by good at it, I mean, it's not just like spending hours playing. It's kind of doing your homework on the history of the music and where's it been and how did they used to dance to it? And then how do you make new music? Because it's not just about playing old music. It's about, what do we have to say now that's relevant, you know, for the next journey, for the next generations?
And as you said earlier, you know, through your music, you're a part of community. You've also built community. You founded the San Francisco Scottish Fiddlers, who have a concert. You all have a concert coming up April 25th through April 27th. How did that group change your life? Because I read you put an ad in the newspaper. Now it's like, you guys have 80 people now. You put an ad in the newspaper back in the day.
Oh, yeah, because it's this follow your heart thing. One of the best things in life is when you're interested in something and you find other people that are interested in the same thing. It's like, yay, game on. You know, let's get together and explore it. And that's what happened. You know, I found so many people that were interested in my case, the Scottish fiddle and the different techniques and the different sounds and just the joy of it. So we used to meet in my house and then we would gather. And we got, you know, we outgrew that and we got went to bigger places and we put signs up in libraries just before the internet. So, you know, we used to get the word out in those days by putting things in newspapers or putting signs up in libraries and saying, hey, you want to, if you're interested in this, come to my house on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock and let's gather and play some tunes. So that's how it all began. And I just went from there. So you end up with this hugely enthusiastic tribe of people who want to play the music together.
And you all have been doing that for a long time. I watched the videos and I could tell you all are having fun just, you know, jamming out like that. It's really a pleasure to watch. Just joining us, I'm speaking with the great fiddler Alistair Frazier, and we're talking about his upcoming concert and some other things. They're going to have some shows April 25th in Davis, April 26th in San Rafael, April 27th in Santa Rosa, and we'll have links to all the information on our website. So yeah, Alistair, speaking of the San Francisco Scottish Fiddlers, I understand that you are leaving the organization. Yeah, so tell us what's going on and what are your next steps?
Well, you know, I've been doing this for a long time and I love it. And I just feel like there's such wonderful energy in the group. It's vibrant, it's vital, great players. And I think we're living at a time when we really need to empower the next generations to, you know, lead and move in. And I'm excited to be able to say that we have people that can do that. I think it's part of the whole journey to create the excitement and get people interested. And I've been doing that for, you know, over 40 years. And it just seems like a good idea to me. You know, I still love playing and I will always do that. I like the idea of moving the energy forward. Music is an important thing to do right now. So that's all. You know, I'll be there hale and hearty leading the charge as usual. And that's it. So just to recommend people come to the concert and get some music and and see what it's like to be part of this vibrant group.
Will you still perform with them sometime, or are you going to completely just step away?
Oh, I don't know. Who knows? I have a busy performing life. And right now, I just want to celebrate the energy that we have and that we're having at the concerts. That's it. We'll deal with the other questions later.
Okay. I want to talk about Natalie Haas. You performed a tour with her for a while now. And I love the matchup of the fiddle and the cello, especially their different sizes, different sounds. Can you talk about how those sounds complement each other?
Well, they absolutely complement each other. They've grown up together, they're like siblings. Going back, especially in Scottish music, which is my tradition, we go back centuries for people playing for dances with just a fiddle and a cello, violin and cello. That was it. Nothing else. And, the cello brings in the bass, that aspect of the dance. People love to get a good bass, a good rhythm section. And I happen to play with one of the best in the business. She's like a groove meister on the cello. And we'll have that in the fiddle concerts too. Natalie won't be there, but we have other people that are bringing up the rhythm. And rhythm is so important in many cultures that gets people moving, like the dance energy is an important part of the equation. So that's what we do. We celebrate, even just with a fiddle and a cello, we can get a lot of big energy going. And that's partly the seduction of this music, I think, is that it's ultimately dance music, and we get to celebrate that.
Definitely listening to it, it's hard to sit in your seat still, when you're on those strings, Mr. Frazier. So how did you and Natalie come together?
Oh, I've known Natalie since she was a kid. So Natalie came to one of my fiddle camps. This is what I mean about encouraging the younger folks. She and her sister came to my fiddle camp when she was 11. And so that was a long time ago. And pretty soon, after a few years, there's a lot of kids come to these camps. But it was pretty obvious that Natalie really wanted to play this music. And she was, just very, very good at it, and like interested in it and wanted to include it in her life. So who would have thought? But here we are now. We've been touring on the road for 25 years. So it's a beautiful thing. That's part of my message, is that I feel lucky to be part of this generational continuum, where we pass the energy on. And there are a lot of things in life where I think we do better when it's multi-generation. We don't just hang out with the kind of people our own age. The village does better when we've got the older folks hanging out with the younger folks, and they're learning from each other and they're nurturing each other. That's the kind of village I want to live in.
My grandmother, she's in her 90s, and she says that too. Like, she likes to have young people around because she likes to keep up with what other young people are saying. She says she learns from young people. And yeah, so that's very important to her, to have different ages of people around her.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the life, source of life right there. And then to get to, she'll have wee nuggets of wisdom, I'm sure, that she loves to share too.
Oh, yeah. She loves to share that. Yeah. She's a lot of fun, too.
I can tell from your voice. That's a lot of fun.
I don't have to convince her heart to do something, to go out or something. She'll do it. So I want to go back to the concerts, the spring concerts that you have coming up. April 25th in Davis, April 26th in San Rafael, April 27th in Santa Rosa. So what can people expect?
Well, the first thing I'd say is you expect joy. Because it is, and I use that word a lot, but it's the joy of a bunch of people from all, as we've been saying, all ages, all walks of life, hanging out, doing something they love, and doing something they've worked at, that they've adopted into their lives. And one of the big things we do is we're not reading music. We learn this music. We know it. It's kind of part of our force, that these people, they get fluency in the music that we're playing. So we're playing by ear and playing by the heart, and there's a lot of smiles, a lot of sharing, and a lot of spontaneity. I love where I get to kind of mix it up and say, let's have a solo here and let's have a song here. And in a way, it's kind of like an old-fashioned gathering that people would do to entertain themselves. And we're inviting the audience into the middle of this. It's like going into the living room, and having a ceilidh, having a gathering. And I think people just, they relax, you know. Oh, this is fun. I could do that myself. I might want to join this group, you know. Where's my grandfather's fiddle? I mean, I might go and dust it off. And so it's that. It's about inclusion, but it's also about the power of music, you know. It serves to lift us and to remind us of what's important and how we can look out for each other and celebrate each other. And there's a voice, there's a space for everyone, you know, in the choir sort of thing. So we have some of the best players in the tradition, mixing it up with some of the people who are learning the tradition. And I think that makes people feel comfortable. You know, it's about, as I keep using this analogy of the village, it's what happens when you visit the village and there's a great fiesta happening and you happen to be there that night. It's like the best thing, you know, if you're traveling and you turn up in some little village in the middle of Spain or something and there's a fiesta. It's like, oh my gosh, this is what these people do. And it's good for us. So that's what it's like. We invite you into our living room and we have a great time. And we encourage you to dance in the aisles and, you know, just get involved. Or you can just sit there quietly and absorb. But the energy is going to be big and it's fun.
All right. So that sounds like a party. Mr. Alistair Fraser, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, and I appreciate what you're doing.
That was Scottish fiddler and composer Alistair Fraser. Check out the San Francisco Scottish Fiddler Spring Concerts on April 25th at the Veterans Memorial Theater in Davis, April 26th at Angelico Concert Hall on the campus of Dominican College in San Rafael, and April 27th at Sonoma Country's Day School's Jackson Theater in Santa Rosa. And coming up, an opera about a favorite fictional vigilante comes to San Jose. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. Okay, so guess the fictional character I'm describing. He's a vigilante who dresses in all black, wears a mask, has a cape, and fights corruption. If you guess Batman, you're wrong. But if you guess Zorro, you are correct. The opera Zorro opens this Saturday, April 19th at Opera San Jose. And the story takes place in Los Angeles in the early 1800s, where Zorro defends poor people, those who are enslaved, and indigenous people. The show includes romance, humor, suspense, and some sword action. And here to tell us more on the phone is the show's composer, Hector Armienta. Hello, Mr. Armienta. Welcome.
How are you, Janae?
So good to have you. Before we jump into Zorro, I just want to talk about your career. You are the founder and artistic director of Opera Cultura, forgive me if I mispronounced that, which is the only Latinx opera company in the country. And as a composer, your work has been performed here in the U.S. and abroad, and you've been honored with awards and esteemed fellowships. What led you to opera?
Well, that's a good question. I'll try to make it quick.
Okay.
So I was I grew up in LA, and I had written a youth opera called Un Camino de Fe. It was my first, you know, try at opera, and I did okay. And I decided that I needed to do more work, and then I moved up to San Francisco. And I just found that, and I went to the Conservatory of Music to get my master's, and I just found that opera really is a great way of telling stories. And there's, you know, to have the orchestra be part of the performance, it just makes a huge difference. So I just love it.
Where'd you grow up in L.A.? I used to live in L.A. Where'd you grow up in L.A.?
I grew up close to MacArthur Park, 3rd and Alvarado, a little west of downtown L.A.
Oh, okay. I used to live near, I guess they would call it Midtown, so like off the 10, like Pico and La Brea.
Okay, I know where that is.
Okay, yeah, that's where I lived for a long time. Anyway, back to your work. So I read on your website that you look at what it means to be Mexican-American through a lens of classical music and opera, and you've composed other works, of course. So I thought that was interesting. So tell me about that. Like, how has classical music or opera taught you about being Mexican American?
Well, I mean, in terms of my interest to with classical music, you know, we didn't grow up listening to classical music, but I was, you know, I went on a field trip in elementary school to the Music Center, which is this great cultural center in downtown LA, and got introduced to classical music. And there was something so incredible about the sound, you know, when you put all these musicians together and then the kind of, you know, what classical music is. And I just started to listen to it more. And then I decided to play the piano. I'm Chicano, you know, which is what we used to call ourselves back in the day, which just means you're, you know, your ancestry is Mexican, but you're born in the States. Mm-hmm. And in some ways the Latinos have been here for a very long time. But we're not Mexican, and we're not quite, what people classify as American. We're two different cultures. And as I was growing up, as an adult, I was trying to figure out who I was culturally. And so it was so music, and I guess through classical music, I try to figure that out.
Interesting.
And the way I figure that out is combining, the Eurocentric classical art form infuse it with music from my culture. And that's how I find it. That's sort of my musical journey, always been.
Yeah, and I was, reviewing some of your past works, and I love how you do weave, like you said, like music that's more maybe from like Mexican culture with like classical European culture. It's really cool how you do that, and I just think that's amazing that to even. I was just thinking it when I was looking at some of your, like I said, your past works, and I was thinking about just the idea of writing an opera, of composing an opera. Because it's music, but it's also storytelling. What is that writing process, that creative process like for you?
Well, I'm a reluctant writer, or an opera we call ourselves, we call ourselves librettist.
Yes.
That's what you would call, in musical theater, you would call someone like that a playwright. So I'm first a composer, and then I write the libretto. And it's a very long discussion about what it's, what my process is like. But I found myself writing the libretto just because I wanted to be more in control of the storytelling and the music telling of the work. I'm able to have that kind of flexibility. So if there's a phrase or a sentence that doesn't quite work musically, I just have a conversation with myself and I change the text to make it work. So it's just been easier for me.
How long did it take you to compose Zorro?
Well, Zorro took, I don't work on a piece, on an opera every day, but for Zorro, I think it was 3 to 4 years working on it, because I work on the story, which is a synopsis, two-page description, and then I break it down into scene by scenes on little index cards. I'm just talking about the writing, the words.
Yeah.
Then I from the scene by scene, then I put it into, a larger synopsis with more description, and then it goes to libretto. And then at the same time, I'm coming up with some musical ideas. Making it all work. It's a long process.
No, that's why I asked, and I respect that you have that gift to be able to do that, the gift of music and the gift of storytelling.
If I could just add a little bit to that, is that it takes me about a year generally to write the libretto, while at the same time having some musical ideas of what it's going to be. And then it takes another year to year and a half to write we call the piano vocal score, which is setting the music for the piano accompaniment and the singers. And then another year to write it for the orchestra. So these are three, big things you have to do when you write an opera. So.
Wow. So definitely it takes creative patience. Definitely.
Yeah.
So what made you decide to tell the story of Zorro?
Well, I had... before writing Zorro, I had decided to write at least three big works, it was Blessed Me Ultima, which is based on a novel by Rodolfo Naya, mm-hmm. And that one was produced in Upper Southwestern New Mexico. And then the other piece I wanted to write was Zorro, and the third was or is the last part of a trilogy. That final piece is called La Muerte. But Zorro I've always wanted to do. I think it's a great story. We're going to probably go into it a little bit, but it's a great story, and I wanted to draw on California history, which is one of the great things that Isabella Allende does. She tells these great stories, but she draws on history, which makes it really, really culturally relevant, but mm-hmm. also really interesting, I think.
No, she's definitely good at that. And speaking of California history, so again, the story is set in the early 1800s, and L.A. was a colony of Spain, right? And Zorro is of Spanish descent, and he's defending oppressed people who are poor, people who are indigenous. Can you talk about the significance of him, like, just at that time, historically, and then, well, as far as what the story said at that time, and then the significance of this character being Spanish? I thought it was interesting that he's Spanish protecting indigenous people, because I'm thinking of, like, colonization.
Yeah. So if Zorro is, you know, there are different versions of the story, right? But it all has the same kind of shape. You know, it's just this masked hero that comes to save the day. You know, there's a comedic character, there's a love interest, there's the final big battle. So it has all of the hallmarks of what people are expecting of Zorro, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of sword fighting, actually, too, in the work. Being, you know, again, drawing on my interest as a Mexican-American, Latinos have been here a long time. And, you know, and Spain conquered the Americas, colonized it. And so the work takes place right at the time when the Spanish Empire was crumbling. Mm-hmm. They started to lose power because there were these sort of embers of revolution that were happening, you know, in what they called New Spain, which would be, you know, Central America, South America, and then, of course, Alta California, mm-hmm. you know, and the you know, what we call now Texas and New Mexico and all that. So Diego comes from Spanish, I'm going into the story. I should go back a little bit in terms of the characters. So okay. Diego's fictional, right?
Right.
There was never any, you know, Diego de la Vega or Zorro. Mm. But in the opera, there is a villain Moncada, and that actually was a real person that came from Mexico, Spanish ancestry, and then was sent by Spain to go up north and help colonize or create these missions in California. Mm-hmm. There's also the character Toparina, which has not ever been in any of the Zorro storytelling, which she was a Tongva Native American who led the first rebellion against the missionaries. In San Gabriel. So, and she sort of plays a mentor. And then another fictional character, which is different from, you know, if you know the Antonio Banderas movies, right? Mm-hmm. His love interest was someone who was Spanish, but the love interest in my opera, she's indigenous. She's mestiza. She is, which mestiza means someone who has sort of, you know, European blood and someone who has indigenous blood. Mm-hmm. So, The way the opera said is Diego's a young man. I'm not going to, there's like an epilogue, which I won't go into, but
yeah, because we don't want to spoil
a young man. yeah. He's a young man looking for his search of his destiny. Okay. And he's always had this love interest of Ana Maria. And it's through her that he realizes what his destiny is supposed to be, which is to fight for the poor, you know, and the destitute. And what's also a little bit different in my Zorro is that it's not just about his journey, but about the journey of the people. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, it's the people in the opera that help Zorro
win the day. Well, don't tell too much.
Okay.
We want people to go to the show.
Yeah, that's right. But in general, the show is also about the empowerment of the people. It's not just one person saving the day. It's that the power truly lies with us.
Yes. And that's what, and I definitely picked up on that, you know, watching. And so there's the power of the people, you know, finding your purpose. And you said there's a lot of sword action, fighting.
There's a lot of sword action, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And as I kind of mentioned, I said, you know, it takes place in 1811. And there's also some history about what happened in Mexico with Padre Hidalgo leading a rebellion in Mexico. The two kings of Spain, there's incorporated in the storytelling of Zorro. The two kings of Spain, the son and the king, the son and his father were fighting for power. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the reasons that Spain and the new Spain were sort of falling apart.
After all of these years, why do people still like Zorro, you think?
Why do people still like Zorro?
It's still a draw, you know?
Well, you know, I think one is, of course, the sword fighting. You know, there's something powerful about that, you know? But I think there's also the fight for justice. It's when we as people feel that we are being wronged. Mm-hmm. We still believe that there is hope. And I think the character Zorro empowers that. That even when the odds are stacked against us, we can still change the world.
Right.
And I think that's part that Zorro does.
Yeah.
And so in some way, we want to be that Zorro. We want to be the one fighting for justice.
And I will have to say as a woman that, you know, Zorro not bad to look at.
Yeah.
And it's something about a man in a cape and a sword coming to rescue you.
Yeah. Very true. Very true. Yeah. They really cast the show well. He's a great, you know, his name is Javier Prado. He's a great tenor. Mm-hmm. And his love interest, Ana Maria, she's a wonderful soprano named Maria Brea. And they put together a great cast, because this is the fourth production of Zorro.
Okay.
And he performed in the Opera Santa Barbara production.
Oh, okay.
But this one, I mean, Opera Santa Barbara is going all out. I mean, the set, the costumes, the lighting, phenomenal.
And I was thinking, we have to wrap up in about 30 seconds, but I was thinking too, just the costumes of that era, just the beautiful costumes and the colors.
Oh, yeah.
And also too, it was bilingual, so it's in Spanish and English as well, which just the beauty of the languages too, they all work. So yeah, I'm excited. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. And I really appreciate you, you know, mentioning it to your listeners, and I hope you all come out and see it.
Absolutely. And definitely, you must come back for your next show.
All right.
Yes.
I will.
Yes, the invitation is open. Thank you so much. Okay. All right, everybody. The opera Zorro opens this Saturday, April 19th, and it runs until May 4th. Okay, so you got to check it out. You can experience it at Opera San Jose. Next up, an artist who makes food look real good with his camera. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darton. Have you ever been like flipping through a magazine and food is far from your mind until you see a picture of a juicy hamburger or a cool, sweet scoop of ice cream, and then you get hungry? Well, there are people behind the camera who capture those delicious images. Shava Oropesa is one of them. The Oakland-based food photographer has shot images for major brands such as Pete's Coffee. And I spoke with him about how growing up in Mexico City influences his artistry and love for food. Shava, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Your work is so beautiful, and I can definitely see the influence of your background and your work. I could see the energy and the color. And of course, Mexico has some of the best food on the planet.
For sure.
Yes. What is one of your special memories that you have with food growing up in Mexico City?
A friend of mine went to Mexico City, and I point him to a very specific store in downtown Mexico. And that's also one of my very favorite memories of food. It's a candy store that's been open since the 1800s. I'm not kidding. And they make classic Mexican candy, and it's called La Dulcería de Celaya. So I told him, just go visit it. You're not going to be disappointed. It's something that's very unique. And I remember as a little kid, my dad and my mom would go downtown, and we make a point to stop at that store and buy some candies. And my favorite candy was this. It's like shredded coconut inside a lime rind, a candied lime rind. So you eat the whole thing, the whole lime rind with the coconut inside. And that, every time I see it, immediately brings memories.
Oh, that's so sweet. I know it's something about food, like the aroma or just seeing it, or yeah, it just takes you back.
I'm a graphic designer by trade. So in Mexico City, when you study graphic design, it's kind of like a BA, basically. It takes like 4 years to complete it. Out of those 4 years, you have to take at least 3 or 4 semesters of photography. So fast forward, I graduated. I always worked for American companies. I was art director for Pepsi for a long time. And then when I moved to the US, the companies I started working for, they needed photography, but they didn't have the budget. So I thought, and I needed photography to do the designs, but I thought I'll just do it myself because I need it. So I started shooting their products, and then kind of started evolving into shooting their social media, shooting their marketing, and other friends and clients were like, hey, could you help us shoot this? Could you help us shoot that? And slowly it snowballed into now I enjoy doing photography way more. And more of my services are focused into showing photography, sharing photography, than actually selling packaging design and branding experience. But I think it connects it very well. It gives me a great advantage because I do have that graphic eye, that very visual art director eye when I am actually shooting and producing images for my clients.
Okay. So...
yes.
I was teasing you before we started the interview. I said, you get us in trouble. Because when we're trying to, sometimes, not all your photos are like this, but I'm like, I don't need a donut. And then I see a picture of a donut and it's chocolate dripping.
Yep, that happens.
And I'm like, and I got an apple in my hand with that chocolate dripping off that donut, Chava. And you know, you're doing your job, and you do a good job. So what all entails? What are the variables? What all entails to, you know, making a really good shot of food?
So, food photography or commercial photography—that's basically used, as you said, to create and crave the cravings in people and make people drive them to go from seeing the image to purchasing the product. It's very much a big collaborative work. What people don't know is that behind the scenes, there's obviously a huge part of art direction and a huge part of planning from the client side. And then from the photographer side, there's also big planning that we work with a crew. And for example, I work with food stylists. I work with prop stylists, photographer assistants, digitechs. I can't break it down what it is so I can explain it. But obviously the food stylist is in charge of making the food look good, making it look pretty and bright and fresh, or anything that needs to happen. The prop stylist helps with anything that's going to be a plate, a glass, a spoon, an item, anything that's going to help dress up the scene. And then I come in place to light up the scene and kind of define where, how's the angle, how is it going to be shot, how is it going to be lit, how is it going to be shown. It is a big collaborative effort. It's not only me. Sometimes with some clients, it's only me and I have to do all these little jobs myself. Mm-hmm. And sometimes with larger clients, it's a crew of 10 people or something like that. So it very much depends.
So often when I go to a restaurant,
yep.
my dish may not look like what's on the poster or on the commercial or on the menu. Yeah. So, and I've watched documentaries about how, I don't know if the right term to say, food models are kind of enhanced. So how do you all make the food? Like, what are little things that, I mean, you know, I've heard like they may put things in a hamburger or something to make them look higher and taller. What are some of the things that you all do to enhance the image of the food, the beauty of the food?
Got it. Yeah. So I think first I want to kind of disperse a big myth that's going out there, which is, some people ask me like, oh, is it true that you use glue instead of milk? Is it true that you use shaving cream instead of whipped cream?
Is it, right, I've heard that.
All those little videos are out there explaining all these odd techniques. So first of all, legally you cannot do any of those things, because it is misrepresentation. So if I'm shooting ice cream, there's a way to make fake ice cream, which looks like real ice cream, but obviously holds up better on set, and it doesn't melt faster. If I'm a company that's selling ice cream, legally I cannot use fake ice cream. That's a no. You can get sued, you can get in trouble. If I'm a company that's selling ice cream syrup, I may be able to use fake ice cream because I'm using the real syrup. So as long as what you are selling is the real product, you can do certain things to enhance that food item.
So like you said, if you're shooting ice cream, and I'm thinking because you're doing photography, so there's a lot of lights, and it may take hours for a shoot. I mean, I'm thinking if it's 10 people on a shoot, possibly, then it may take hours. So when you're when you're shooting something that can melt like ice cream, do they have like just several cones prepared in case you need to switch them out? And is that more of a challenging shoot too?
I would say out of everything that you shoot for food, ice cream is known to be like the hardest thing to shoot because of that. It melts in seconds. You have like literally seconds to take the capture, and the ice cream is done. So there's tricks that the food stylist can do to help that. Some of this is like you pre-scoop the ice cream, you freeze the scoops of ice cream, and then you bring them into set at the last moment after you light up the scene and get everything ready. You use what we call a stand-in, which is kind of like same thing as the movies. You have a stand-in to help light before the real talent shows up, right?
Yeah.
So same thing happens with food photography. You have a stand-in that helps you get everything ready, and then you bring in the real, what we call the hero product. And then the hero comes in, we shoot it, and we have to capture it fast.
So on May 23rd, 2024, Google displayed your chilaquiles photo on their homepage. And chilaquiles is a Mexican breakfast dish. When I saw it, I said, oh my goodness, it looks so good. It's like corn tortilla strips and chiles on there and salsa and cheese and cream and yummy, 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 all kind of good stuff. I was like, ooh, that's a hearty breakfast dish. I think you could put some chicken on it if you want.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll get you through the day. And I looked at it and I said, ooh, if I saw that in the morning, I'd be going down the street to my one of my favorite Mexican restaurants. Why did you, I don't know, did Google choose that dish, or did you choose that dish to be for the Google Doodle for that day?
Google contacted me and reached out to me to offer me this project. They were looking to create this doodle specifically with chilaquiles, specifically for this day. So they reached out to me and they asked me if I would be interested and wanted to do this project with them. In all honesty, when I got the first email, I really thought it was a prank. I was like, this is not true. Come on now. But obviously it was not a prank. The Google team was super, super friendly, super nice, and explained to me what they were looking for. What I believe, they let me know, this is the first time they've actually done any doodle with photography, because all their doodles are illustrations. So the process to do illustration, it's definitely way different than doing the photography. So they were like, okay, how would you want to drive this process? Because we don't have a roadmap for doing photography. So that was a lot of fun, because I was able to kind of like drive this project. I would send them sketches of the ideas that I wanted and see what they thought about them. We narrowed them to one idea that they really enjoyed. And then from there, we tweaked a couple of things on the illustration before, because I also like to illustrate whatever I'm going to create beforehand.
Yeah, I caught that. I was like, wow, you're really talented. I mean, I know from the photos, but yeah, you're just super talented. Mm.
Thank you. So from there, literally, we went from the approval of the illustration to the shoot. And I shot the dish with the chilaquiles and the tortilla strips. And yes, they were real. The letters are real tortilla strips. I was cutting them with my little X-Acto knife. I fried them.
And
shot the whole thing. It took me a day to shoot it and also kind of like animate it. And once everything was completed and done, we delivered everything to the Google team, and it was scheduled for May 23rd, and it got published. It was pretty awesome, and I was very proud of actually producing something that represented Mexican food and Mexican culture, and I enjoyed it a lot. The plate that I used is one of the plates that my mom actually bought me. And so even having that as a part of the project was really meaningful to me.
Well, since you mentioned your mother, might as well talk about her. That's a project that you have now called Con Mucho Cariño, which means a lot of love. And it's a collection of your late mother's recipes. And it's on your website, and you explain why each dish is important and also to how to make it. And so I know your parents have been an influence in your love for food. Why did you want to share these recipes, your mother's recipes, with your followers and your fans?
Well, this is kind of like a project that has been in my brain for a long time, I would say years. And my mom left behind her cookbook, which is all handwritten and obviously in Spanish. And I always thought, oh my God, I would love to do something with these recipes. And I give them some sort of life and honor the memory of my mom. And I really didn't know how to come about it, to be honest, until I worked with a consultant that she helped me kind of helped me kind of guide my photography business. And her name is Amy V. Cooper, and I will forever be grateful to her. And she's the one that said, why don't you cook your mom recipe? Cook it, take photos, like see how it inspires you. And that way I started kind of like each month or each 2 months cooking a recipe, taking photos, posting on my website, sending it out in my newsletter. And part of it was fulfilling that, sharing my mom's recipes and honoring her memory. And part of it has been a big driving force in the creative part of my business, because I'm the client on those shoots. I decide what I want. I can choose to explore crazy colors, crazy layouts, or whatever I want to do. It doesn't matter. It's for me. And I've found that doing that has really opened up my creative channels, to say so, because sometimes I'm thinking of shooting something with my mom's recipes, and the style or the colors or the way I shoot it, I can immediately kind of like use it for another real project. So it is kind of like a creative playground, but it's also, as I said, a great way to share this amazing recipes that I grew up with, because they're real recipes. They're not fancy recipes. They're everyday Mexican food. It's the stuff that I would have every day that my mom would cook for us.
That was food photographer Chava Oropesa. You can visit Chava's website and Instagram page for his photos and recipes, and we'll have links to all of that on our website. And that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darton. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, our board operator, Tariq Ansari, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And before I go, I want to give a few shout out to Macy's Union Square manager, Jonathan Davis, and his team. They hosted a fashion show for my sorority last weekend, right in the middle of the store. And we had so much fun. The public had so much fun. They did a great job. So shout out to them. Make sure you check out Freight and Salvage in Berkeley. They have some really good shows coming up. Also, shout out to Ellen Sebastian Chang. She directed The Boiling at the Magic Theater in San Francisco. And it's some sort of like science mystery play. And it wraps up this weekend. So you may want to check that out. Shout out to the record label Empire and their CEO Ghazi. The mayor of San Francisco honored them yesterday on 415 Day and proclaimed to Empire Day. And you can go to our website to read my interview with him and other Empire artists, including country star Shaboozy. Shout out to everybody in Frisco for 415 Day. Ryan Coogler's vampire film Sinners comes out this weekend, and it's been getting rave reviews, so you may want to check that out. Also, to check out Valerie Trout, shout out to her. Her jazz and poetry celebration at Wildflower in West Oakland is on Friday night, and I think I might check that out because their shows are really good. So, yeah, it's a lot going on this weekend. I know it's Easter weekend. Thank you all so much for tuning in. We appreciate you. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. You know what I'm about to do? I'm about to go home, slip into my moo-moo, drink some tea, do all of that. Tariq, our board announcer, is shaking his head because he has been here since 5 this morning. So shout out to him for holding it down here at KLW on the boards. All right, y'all. Until the moo-moo and the tea and all that good stuff, be good to yourselves and each other. Next up is the Arts Hour from the BBC. Thank you.